Mr. Wilbrand, good morning to you. Let's give everybody, we still need to give everybody a moment to get in and out. You may proceed.
May it please the court, justices, I'm Chuck Wilbrand and I represent the appellant in this case, Johnny Davis. In 2012, Johnny Davis was lawfully granted parole for crimes that he committed on May 10, 1995. In June of 2014, that was well documented, the State Department of Corrections started rounding up prisoners throughout the state for prisoners that had been erroneously granted parole. Mr. Davis wasn't initially on this list to be rounded up, but his name was added to the list and a warrant was issued and he was called to turn himself in.
Do we know who had it, who added him to that list?
We do not know, Your Honor.
And do we know whether it's any of the defendants in this case?
I do not know. When he was told to come up, and this court has heard three different cases regarding this, I'll refer to as the prisoner roundup of 2015. And the main factor that is different in Mr. Davis's case as opposed to those three other cases is that Mr. Davis was lawfully released on parole. They calculated his time correctly in 2012. Because in 1995, May 10, 1995, he committed the crimes he was ultimately convicted. June of 1995, LB 371 gets signed into law. LB 371, Section 13, added the mandatory minimum sentencing of 10 years for habitual criminals. Then that part, that section of LB 371 became effective in September of 1995. So, when Mr. Davis was arrested on May 10, 1995, was no mandatory minimum sentencing for habitual criminals. So he served his time, he rehabilitated himself through the prison system, which is what we always hope happens with prisoners, and he was released on parole in 2012.
You referred to date of arrest, but it's actually date of offense compared to the date of the new law that would be the...
And it was the same time. Date of offense and date of arrest were all on May 10th.
Thank
so
you.
You're saying at the time the crime was committed, there was no mandatory minimum for habitual criminals?
The statute did not have a mandatory minimum. It just had a minimum sentencing. Now, the state has and the defense have raised that the Board of Parole has quasi-judicial immunity and they cannot be held liable for their actions in this case. In a case that we did not mention in our brief, but I have found subsequently, and that is Pratt versus State, 252 Nebraska 906. In that case, it was a writ of mandamus by Pratt where he was denied a parole hearing, which he felt he was entitled to, and the Board of Parole essentially said, well, we didn't need to give you a hearing anyways because we have discretion. This court ruled and held it was a ministerial act. Therefore, they needed to grant him the parole hearing. In this case, there is no discretion involved when Mr. Davis's parole was revoked. It was all ministerial because it's controlled by the statute of whether a mandatory minimum sentence applies. In this case, Mr. Davis did not have a mandatory minimum sentence. So I don't know why he can be brought back in and said, you are here because we miscalculated your parole because you owe a mandatory minimum sentence. And Mr. Davis continually tells them, no, it doesn't apply to me. Check. They don't check. Show a deliberate indifference.
Counsel, has your client served half of the maximum sentence?
Half of the maximum sentence?
Correct.
And that, I believe, of the two crimes he was committed combined, correct? Mm-hmm. He has not served half of the maximum sentences.
Okay, then when the parole board, you become eligible for parole, there's no mandatory parole, correct?
You become eligible.
So when you become eligible, isn't that a discretionary function?
What do you When you become eligible, it is calculated.
If you haven't served half your maximum to completely get out of prison, when you become eligible and a parole board looks at you, there's no requirement that they parole you, correct?
There's no requirement.
So they look at factors like rehabilitation, your performance in prison, et cetera, et cetera. They look at factors and then make a decision similar to what a judge does, correct?
Correct. But in this situation, during his parole hearing, the parole board is acting like their hands are tied because they have to give him a mandatory minimum sentence.
Isn't this really a parole eligibility issue?
As in, there's a question about when he was eligible for parole based upon this habitual criminal new statute, the amendment to the statute?
It is, but I think you have to look at it as a fact of when they give him parole is determined upon whether the mandatory minimum applies. And that is step one. You have to figure out when was mandatory minimum sentencing effective.
That's his parole eligibility date. Would you agree with that?
Well,
you're not eligible for parole until you serve half the minimum.
Half the minimum. Well, if the mandatory minimum sentence applies, you have to at least serve the 10, and then you...
That wasn't the case in our situation.
That wasn't the case in that situation. So this time, he was eligible for parole because he served half the minimum.
So the question is parole eligibility versus mandatory discharge.
Right. So, and I mean, he was eligible for parole. And he did not,
that was the question why he was rearrested, wasn't it?
Well, he was rearrested because they thought they just miscalculated.
Miscalculated what?
His parole eligibility of mandatory minimum sentence.
Parole eligibility.
Right.
Okay. So that's what we're discussing here.
Right. And but
does the parole board determine parole eligibility date?
No, that's on the Department of Corrections.
Okay. So the parole board just determines if
they go
once they're eligible, they determine whether they've met their standards, they've done their programming, they're good model prisoners, they should be paroled.
Right, because
is that a quasi-judicial proceeding?
Once they start weighing those factors, yes. But at this, you don't even get to that because they're not weighing those factors. They're putting him in because they don't think he's eligible for parole.
Based on information provided by whom?
The Department of Corrections. Because they are the director, and there's multiple duties that we have listed in our brief. Going through there that, you know, they violated those duties.
So would the Department of Corrections be a agency of the state and have sovereign immunity?
I don't believe so, not in this, because they're not doing a discretionary function.
Under 1983 action, does it matter it's a discretionary function?
Well, under a 1983 action, no.
And there's two claims for 1983.
There's two claims for 1983. Fourteenth Amendment claim for his general rights and the cruel and unusual punishment by showing it an indifference. And that's why the members have been sued in their individual
Can you sue the state or its agencies under 1983?
Under 1983, no. But the
or money losses.
Correct. But there are the other members that's why they have been all sued in their individual capacities too, which is allowed by the 1983 case.
Isn't there a basic problem that you haven't nailed down who did what?
Well, I don't know how I'm supposed to find out who did what until there is discovery. And I know that is difficult that I have added all these people in here, but when I look at it, you know, whether it's qualified immunity that the district court also gave, and that is, you got to have some mode of discovery to find out. I don't know how Johnny Davis or me is supposed to know who did what without actually nailing it down and having the opportunity to look at who did what. I mean, and I think these satisfied claims that qualified immunity shouldn't just be granted. He said that there is the clear constitutional claims. And
I had a question about your negligence issue.
Okay.
The negligence claims that they were negligent in doing what?
Well,
determining the eligibility date?
Right, and that they had statutorily had duties to do things as well. And in the,
is that in essence a false imprisonment claim?
I don't believe it is.
Okay, and why not?
It's not false imprisonment because the fact is that there's not an intent to hold him. And I think it's more of a, he was still harmed. And in my brief, you know, I mentioned that it was, even though the complaint itself doesn't say negligent supervision or negligent infliction of emotional distress. I think the elements are there of those claims that if I'd been allowed to amend my complaint to fix some of the problems that the judge ruled on, I think we would have been able to satisfy that. I think I should have been allowed to amend the complaint because it's a notice pleading statute. I think I pled notice effectively in that, and if I could have incurred it, it was early on in the case, there was no bad faith, would have been prejudicial to anybody, so at that point, I'm out of time, and I would ask that the court overrule what the district court had ruled. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Kumar.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice.
Did I get that accurate?
You did. That was close. And may it please the court. The district court dismissed Davis's claims against the parole board for two reasons. Finding quasi-judicial immunity applied and sovereign immunity applied. They dismissed the claims against the non-parole board athletes for two reasons. Sovereign immunity and that his negligence claim was not actionable. And the district court decided correctly that the federal claims were not proper under any circumstances. I'd like to first focus on the parole board and quasi-judicial immunity, and there are 4 points I'd like to make.
Well, could you first set forth the facts upon which this claim is based? In other words, he was sentenced in 1995, and he was paroled then after he'd served, or he was paroled when he became parole eligible?
That's correct.
And then he was released.
In 2012, he was paroled.
Yes, okay, paroled. And then corrections made the determination that he hadn't served his required sentence because habitual criminal required a mandatory minimum?
Yes, at the time, this is when the Department of Corrections... Well,
somebody made the determination that he was not out, he was released too early.
Yes.
Do we know who that is?
No, we do not, and it's not in the record. And. But, there's a variety of reasons that I think it doesn't matter, but...
Who typically would do that? Corrections would typically do that, wouldn't they?
Would decide parole eligibility.
And whether or not they'd release somebody too early.
Yes.
Okay, so then he's re-arrested.
In 2014.
And what's his claim based on?
His claim is based on parole revocation.
Okay. And does he have a cause of action that survives immunity?
No, Your Honor, we believe he does not. As this court has repeatedly held, parole is a matter of grace and discretion, not right. So although he was paroled in 2012, he remained in the custody of the state and was subject to reincarceration at any time so long as he was afforded a hearing. He makes clear in his complaint that he was afforded that hearing and that his revocation was a result of that hearing.
Even though the revocation was arbitrary and unreasonable, because there wasn't any basis to revoke other than the erroneous assumption that he still had to serve a mandatory minimum.
The basis for the revocation, we acknowledge, was a mistake, but that does not equate unlawfulness. And especially in a situation here where he's seeking civil liability and requesting damages from the state for the parole revocation decision.
How would he overcome that?
Mr. Davis could have sought judicial review via petition and error, which I direct the court to 25-1901. He had 30 days to do that, pursuant to 25-1903.
A review and error from what?
The parole decision. He could appeal the parole decision to the district court, have the district court decide whether the parole decision was accurate or not, and the district court would then make that determination.
I beg your pardon. So the decision of revocation, is that what you're saying?
Yes, ma'am.
You believe a decision of revocation by the board would be appealable in a petition and error. Is that
correct? Yeah, as Justice.
That was his opportunity, as you see it.
That was his vehicle for seeking judicial review. Filing a civil complaint for civil damages, and we believe, is barred for a number of reasons. I'd like to turn to the quasi-judicial immunity issue. And I think it's important that public policy favors protecting the parole board from decisions it makes while performing its functions. We task the parole board with looking at facts on a case-by-case basis, and they have to apply their own discretion when deciding how to act on those facts. By definition, that's essentially quasi-judicial in nature.
Was that decision ministerial?
No, it was not. Every decision made by the parole board inherently requires discretion, whether that is to release an inmate on parole or to revoke parole. Even when parolees have violated a condition of parole, there are a number of opportunities or options the parole board has outside of reincarceration.
What about our decision, Pratt versus the state, alleging that, or finding that that was a ministerial act in determining parole eligibility?
Pratt versus state is distinguishable here because in Pratt, that decision was based on a review of his parole eligibility, not the actual decision whether to grant, deny, or revoke parole. Here we're talking about a hearing he had and the basis and the parole board deciding to revoke his parole. In Pratt v. State, they were talking about just simply reviewing the file to determine parole eligibility, not the actual parole eligibility hearing.
What type of immunity are we talking about?
For the parole board?
Mm-hmm.
Quasi-judicial immunity.
Quasi-judicial.
Yes, and we believe that the Court of Appeals decision in Pratt v. Houston applies directly to Davis's state law claims. And in Pratt v. Houston, the Court of Appeals found that the parole board acts in a quasi-judicial manner and that parole board members cannot be held liable for negligent or erroneous decisions made.
Okay, that applies to the parole board. What about the Department of Corrections?
There's two points that I'd like to make on the non-parole board appellees. And Justice Funk touched on false imprisonment. We acknowledge we didn't raise this below or in our briefs, but because it's an issue of subject matter jurisdiction, this court can decide whether or not Davis's claims amount to false imprisonment. And if the court would indulge me in a late citation, in Cole v. Clark, just found at 8 Neb App 614, Cole sought monetary damages for days he spent in prison when he claimed he should not have been in prison. Now, although Cole did not specifically allege false imprisonment, the Court of Appeals considered the substance of his claims to be one of false imprisonment. And the same can be done here. I direct the court to paragraphs 53E and 53H, where Davis respectively alleges that he was reincarcerated without cause, and that he spent 59 days in jail that he believes he should not have spent in jail. If this court reads those claims to amount to a false imprisonment allegation, then I direct the court to 81-8219 subsection 4, where it is clear that the state has not waived its sovereign immunity to claims arising out of false imprisonment. And there's another point I'd like to make regarding the non-parole board appellees.
So, just summary on what you've got so far is you're saying that really his only relief was to take an appeal from the reincarceration.
As it pertains to parole revocations, and in these facts and circumstances, yes.
Okay.
But the parole eligibility date was incorrectly determined by the Department of Corrections. Is there responsibility there?
On which claim, I guess I could ask for clarification.
1983 action.
Regarding the federal claims, the facts and circumstances before this court do not invoke an Eighth Amendment issue. And regarding the 14th Amendment, while he's on parole, he has a limited liberty interest that requires due process. And that requires he have a hearing before he is reincarcerated.
He's on parole, so he doesn't have all the attributes of somebody who is not on parole.
That's correct.
What's the breadth of his liberty interest?
There's specific conditions that the parole board will require that he meet while on parole. None of that's in the record, so we're not clear what his conditions were, but the liberty interest he has is limited, and it requires due process, and he has not alleged any defect in the due process, and specifically makes clear that the state afforded him due process before he was reincarcerated.
Before you run out of time, he argues that he should be allowed, and apparently requested, leave to amend his complaint. Are there any of the individual defendants against whom it would be plausible to assert a 1983 claim?
I'd like to answer that in two parts, Justice Castle. First, it's arguable that he did not request leave to amend below. But second, there is no conceivable amendment that would allow him to proceed on his 1983 claims.
And why is that?
He was in the custody of the state while on parole. So this isn't an Eighth Amendment situation where inmates kept past his discharge date. And regarding 14th Amendment, he had his due process. And we acknowledge that at the outer bounds of the law, there are rough edges. But in this situation, he got what the law affords him.
Well, the only reason he's reincarcerated is because of an error in miscalculation of the parole eligibility date. Can we agree to that?
We can agree that he was reincarcerated because of a mistake of a belief that he was unlawfully on parole when he was in fact lawfully on parole.
I'm sorry, could you remind me the date of the parole hearing, please?
July 29th.
Of what year?
He was originally, of 2014. He was originally contacted June 25th of 2014. He has parole hearing July 29th, 2014, and he was re-paroled August 22nd.
What about qualified immunity? Is there any qualified immunity for any of these individuals?
There is, but this court doesn't need to necessarily affirm on those grounds. For qualified immunity to apply, there's two prongs. The first prong is that he has to state a cognizable constitutional violation that has to be clearly established. It's clear from the facts and circumstances that he fails prong one, which means qualified immunity applies, but this court can also affirm on the grounds that he just hasn't stated proper federal claim.
Is there anything in this record or the pleadings that would indicate at what point the defendants named or unnamed became aware of the miscalculations that had previously ensued?
There's nothing in the pleadings of the record that would suggest that.
And if there was some evidence of miscalculations being known, but nevertheless applying the wrong law, would that demonstrate a deliberate indifference?
Yes, but paragraphs 37, 38, and 41, Davis alleges that all the appellees were under the belief that he was unlawfully on parole. There's no suggestion that anyone maliciously revoked his parole or acted in
I guess what I'm saying is that a deliberate indifference not to know the state of the law at some point.
Further to that point, didn't Mr. Davis tell everyone when he was subject to rearrest and at the parole hearing that new statute, the amendment to the statute, didn't apply to him, and then in fact he was correctly paroled? Didn't he say that numerous times?
That is alleged in his complaint.
So is that deliberate indifference if someone doesn't feather that out a little bit?
No, it wouldn't amount to deliberate indifference, and I just simply note that he specifically alleges that he believed he was unlawfully on parole. To get to deliberate indifference, we would have had to know that he was lawfully on parole and revoke his parole maliciously. And again,
is that foreclosed by the pleadings? In other words, is that a set of facts that could, was it a plausible set of facts?
And I think maybe you're getting into bad faith or some malicious intent.
Well,
here.
I'm just trying to veer into the 1983 area.
Yeah, I believe there's no facts or circumstances here that he could conceivably amend to get over qualified immunity. I mean, it'd be directly at odds with what he's already alleged. And, I mean, he alleges negligence, first of all.
And your view is discovery would also could not yield facts upon which he could succeed.
Correct.
Or at least go
forward. The immunities at issue here provide an insuperable bar that he just cannot get over. There's no conceivable amendment that would allow him to get past quasi-judicial immunity, sovereign immunity, or qualified immunity. And those all apply respectively to the state law claims and federal claims.
Thank you.
I see that I'm out of time. And if I have no further questions, we'd ask that this court affirm the district court's decision. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal? We'll give you a minute, Mr. Wilbrand, if you want to respond to anything that we asked questions about to Mr. Kumari.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a couple of other points real quick is, in his complaint, Mr. Davis did say that the only reason he was released, and he was released within the time period for him to file the 30-day appeal. The Attorney General released him on August 22nd. But that was really only because after his parole was revoked, is that the Omaha World Herald was reporting extensively on this whole prison roundup, and then they started telling, oh, hey, guess what? They got this one right, and they got it wrong again. And it was that press that led to him being granted the parole as well.
Doesn't that lead to an inference that the state actors were not acting recklessly or indifferently, but when they became aware of true facts, they acted?
Well, the Attorney General did, but the Department of Corrections and the Parole Board knew it before then, and when someone is pointing out either computational errors or just errors of in the record that you should look at, that creates a duty to go and check the record and investigate.
Would discovery reveal when the parole board knew the appropriate law?
I believe so. I believe discovery would also show what the directors and the department of whether they actually reviewed his record and whether or not Mr. Davis was maliciously added to have his name added back to the list. We can see maybe it's due in part to the crimes that he was convicted of. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. The next case of the day is In Re Interest of Becca P., which is consolidated for oral argument purposes with In Re Interest of Thomas P. and